everybody. Welcome to One-on-One with Roland Hemond. My name is David Lorillot. I authored the Q&A series at Fangraphs, which means that I have an opportunity to interview people within the game of baseball on a regular, almost a daily basis. I feel very honored and privileged to be here today, not only at Saber 42, but to talk to Roland Hemond. I don't think there's a need for me to introduce Roland. Being Saberites, I think you're all very familiar with him. So we're going to jump right into a question, which is that, Roland, you were a longtime GM for a few teams. So you hired a lot of managers. What was your best hire and why?
Well, I always hate to handpick one special because I was fortunate to be involved with the additional of major league managers from time to time. Naturally, with Tony La Russa, extra special. Tony was in the farm system of the White Sox. He was a utility infielder, had a very short time in the major leagues, was not a star player, but he played on our Denver ball club. And Lauren Babe was the manager, and he said, Roland, he had to ask Tony to run the club a couple of times when Lauren wasn't feeling well. And he said, I think this young man could be quite a manager someday. And Tony wrote me a letter. Here's what happened. When Bill Vick purchased the White Sox for the second time, there was a lockout. And Bill, as creative as he was, said to me in January, we were both staying at the Executive House in Chicago. He said, we're going to open the spring training on March 1. And I'm thinking, what is he going to try to break up the union or crash the gate? And he I was shot down with the flu. So he kept sending me chicken noodle soup about every 3 hours to get well. And then finally I said, Bill, I'll be ready tomorrow. So I came down to his suite. And when we had meetings with Bill, you know, he had to soak his leg in the tub every morning at about 6. And so I'd come down and I'd put the top of the toilet seat down, come in with a cup of coffee and a newspaper. He'd get the aroma of the coffee, said, oh, you're here. Well, he was busy reading a book and shaving at the same time in that tub. So, I mean, you know, very formal. So I said, Bill, what do you have in mind? He said, well, we're going to open spring training on March 1. Really, Bill? How are you going to do that? He said, well, put a team together of 25 of our minor league players so they're not under the umbrella of the player association, the union. That's a pretty good idea. So I made sure to put Tony La Russa's name down as a candidate for that club. And so we did open on April 1st, and we were the only club in spring training. But we were the best covered team in baseball because the writers had made their reservations for Florida and made commitments at hotels or apartments or whatever. So we were covered by the New York Times, the LA Times, Chicago papers, and everybody was gathering at probably the worst club ever assembled, with the semblance of a major league team. And but I told Bill, you should meet Tony La Russa. So one day Tony's walking, we stayed at the Days Inn, real fancy hotel. You know, the lowest price for Bill was the best. And he said to Tony, he was walking with his wife, Elaine. He says, could you come back later this afternoon at such a time? So Tony came by and spent about an hour and a half with Bill that day and another session. And Bill says, you're right, Roland. This is an exceptional young man. And so we hired Tony. We had one opening in our farm system, the Knoxville Club in AA. And I'm trying to think now. Tony wrote me a letter prior to that spring training that he would like to see if he could manage well and how much he would like it. And this was the opportunity to give Tony the AA job. And now he's did a real good job, and he's going to win the first half championship. And Bill said, let's fly down to Knoxville. We can celebrate with Tony when he wins the first half, which he clinched while we were there. And little did I know it, and Bill says, I want you to join our coaching staff in the major leagues under Larry Doby. So Tony became the first base coach. And at the end of the year, he told me that he would like to try managing and would prefer to go managing AAA rather than being a first base coach in the big league. So I approached Bill again, and he said, that's a good idea. And I said, Tony, you know, you ought to go to Dominican Republic to manage, to add to your experience, and then you'll also be seeing players, pitchers and hitters as well, that you'll know a lot more about them as when you become a big league manager. It might help you win some games when you become a big league manager, because it was obvious to me that he had the makeup of being a major league manager. And so he did that, and then we made a managerial change. Don Kessinger was now our manager. And about the first part of August, Bill, when he didn't have an off-season, off-day story, he made one up. He changed managers for one. Anyway, so Tony joined the club on August the 3rd, around something like that, as our manager, and the rest is history. He's going to the Hall of Fame. So recently, for me to go with my wife Margot to St. Louis, and it was retiring Tony's number, I mean, that was very thrilling to see the tremendous ovations he was receiving in St. Louis. Now, when Tony first got as manager, you know, we had two announcers, Harry Carey and Jimmy Pearsall, and they were so critical of Tony's moves. I think they figured, oh, the other excellent part about Tony La Russa, when he became our manager, I didn't realize he was still working towards passing the Florida bar to become a lawyer. He did 12 years of off-season studies to get his degree. I mean, so that shows the dedication of the man and the character that he is, to have that kind of discipline and desire to fulfill goals. And so I take him to, we go to the World Series, and I didn't know at that time that Tony was still studying to pass the Florida bar. So those late games and what have you. And he did pass it the first time around. Not that he ever practices as a lawyer, and other managers look down on him. Here's this smart aleck lawyer, right? Well, there are about four lawyers that are in the Hall of Fame. Hugh Jennings, and you guys would know the three others along with Tony. And anyway, that was a great hire, I want to say, right? And then Bob Lemon, when Bill bought the club, at that time, he was thinking about who to hire as a manager. And I said, how about Bob Lemon? Because Bob had managed in the farm system of the California Angels when I was farm and scouting director. The first year he managed there, they lost 99 games. And he told Jimmy Reese, he said, I got a call from Roland, his coach, Jimmy Reese. He said, I got a call from Roland. He said, if you lose 100, I'm not flying you back to the mainland. You'll have to come in on a canoe. But Bob became our manager, and we had that great year in 77, the Southside Hitmen, and he was manager of the year. So I've had good luck with managers. Johnny Oath was another very good one we had in Baltimore. I don't think the ownership thought he was as good as I thought he was. Can you hear me okay? I should talk louder? Oh, okay. Should I start with my talk all over again? Hey, I thought it was so good at the beginning that those who didn't hear me should hear me. No. But I'll tell you, I'm in a great mood here. You know, as a baseball man, if your club wins the day before, boy, you're ready to go the next day. If you lost, well, you suffered through it, you're ready to go, but not in the same manner. So if you haven't heard, the Arizona Diamondbacks, and I'm working for them now, beat Milwaukee last night. And Aaron Hill, our second baseman, hit for the cycle. It's the second time his cycle in 11 days, and I understand that I heard that somebody said it never happened that soon for a player to hit two cycles within 11 days in baseball history. So we're still making baseball history. Right up the alley of this route, right? And yeah, Paul Goldschmidt, our first baseman, had 4 for 4. So I'm in a great mood today.
I'd like you to talk about the Diamondbacks. How good are the 2012 Arizona Diamondbacks? Could they win the pennant?
Well, our general manager, Kevin Towers, guaranteed that we're going to be in postseason. And ever since he said that, we've been playing better and better and better. Kirk Gibson did an incredible job last year with that club. We have a great staff. Don Baylor is the hitting coach. Alan Trammell, the bench coach. Glenn Sherlock's been with the Diamondbacks and as a coach. He's our bullpen coach. And Eric Young and Matt Williams. So it's a great dedicated group, and they work so beautifully together. And it's a great blend between the front office, Kevin Towers, outstanding baseball man, Derek Hall, our president and executive, president and CEO. I happen to have the fanciest title I've ever had, special assistant to the president, CEO. You know what that means? I can attend the Sabre convention. I don't have to worry about the club. I've become ceremonial.
Let's go back to managers for a moment. Major League history is filled with colorful managers. With the possible exception of Ozzie Guillen, there really aren't a lot now. What do you think of Ozzie? Should there be more Ozzie Guillens in baseball?
Well, Ozzie sometimes will talk more than he should, but I traded for him. I put on, I had told our scout, find us the best shortstop in AAA. And Jerry Krause, well, Dwayne Schaefer. See, I mentioned scouts' names because I realized their importance. Dwayne Schaefer had seen Ozzie in Class A in the California League the year before and turned in a fine report on him. And then the next year, had our scouts going around to find the best shortstop. And Jerry Krause, veteran scout and a good basketball scout as well, helped put the Bulls together. So he's got more rings than anybody. I'm showing off my 2 rings. He's got 7 of them. Thank you, Michael Jordan. But anyway, he kept saying, that little guy can really play. I mean, he put a different adjective in there and described it. But anyway, and Jerry, to convince you, he'll repeat himself on and on again. That little guy can play. That little guy can play. He's the first one on the field taking extra ground balls. He's like the captain of the team. When he was 20 years old, he says, he seems to run the club. He's always top of the pitcher. But later on, when we traded for him and Tom Seaver was on our staff, and Ozzie would go talk to him and say, what the heck do you know about pitching? Get your ass off there. And he kept saying that he wanted to catch the last ball or to make the last put out for Seaver when he would win his 300th game. Well, when Seaver won his 300th game, the last out, it was Don Baylor who hit a fly ball, and I was kind of, ooh, stay in the park. And Ozzie running out there on the warning track, but Reed Nichols called him off the ball. And Reed Nichols says he was never so nervous on a fly ball as that one. And so Seaver won his 300th game in a White Sox uniform. But when we first got Ozzie, and I had never seen him, and the scouts put him down, I think, at 155 pounds. But I think he was closer to 140. But they figured if he weighed 140, I wouldn't want to trade for him because the guy would look like me. Then anyway, Ozzie arrives on the scene at Paint Park in Sarasota, and they said, Ozzie Guillen has arrived. So I go down to greet him, and he's sitting at the trainer's table, the Herman Schneider, great trainer. He has his shirt off. He's got his baseball pants on, and he says, oh, my gosh, I did feel that he was built like me. So after I greeted him, I went back to the office and I contemplated. I said, I'm really worried about this trade. I think we traded for a jockey. So when Ozzie made the 100th century team of the White Sox, and we had some great shortstops, Louie Aparicio, Lou Gatlin, but among 100 top White Sox players, I told that story, and he hadn't heard about it, and he just about fell off the chair laughing. But I think he did weigh closer to 140 to 155.
As a young general manager, you traded for Dick Allen?
Yeah, that's one of my best trades. Fortunately, I had Chuck Tanner as the manager. Chuck Tanner and I were hired together. People realized that if I became a general manager, Chuck would manage in the farm system of the Angels for 8 years at each level, A, double A, triple A. And I thought he should have been the manager of the Angels when Bill Rigney wasn't retained, and then they hired Lefty Phillips. Dick Walsh had come from the Dodgers, and Chuck was managing AAA and had done a fabulous job, but they picked Lefty Phillips. So then at the end of that season, when I became general manager of the White Sox, well, Glenn Miller, the farm director of the White Sox, had recommended me to the owner, John Allen, and Stu Holcomb, the executive vice president. So I had to go to Tucson to be interviewed, or Phoenix rather, by Stu Holcomb. And it didn't take long that they had made up their mind that they would hire me, but then Chuck was a cinch to be the manager. But I didn't know they had flown Chuck Tanner in, and they opened the closet door, and Chuck Tanner stepped out. So then we were delayed in reporting for the press conference. We were announced, but Chuck was tied up in the Pacific Coast League playoffs against Tom Lasorda and the Dodger team. So then I said, we should have a surprise for the press conference because we're old news anyway. And we hired Johnny Sain, who had been a roving pitching coach in the Angels organization, one of the finest pitching coaches in the history of the game. And he had been a great pitcher in his own right. So when we flew in from, I said, I'm going to change your name to Sam Johnson. So you're Bart Johnson's father, so nobody would find out that Johnny Sain's on the flight. I guess we could get away with it in those days. Anyway, when we arrived, I opened the curtain, and I said, we have an announcement to make. Our pitching coach is Johnny Sain, so that was very well received. And that was a masterful move on my part. I might have, and I'll tell you more as we go along. Not credit to me, but credit to Johnny Sain.
Can you talk a little bit more about Dick Allen? Just how talented
and
how controversial he was?
Yeah, well, Dick Allen had been a controversial figure, as you well know, in Philadelphia. And he had 1 year in St. Louis, and then he'd had production numbers, but for some reason or other, they weren't always sure if he'd show up for the game. But anyway, and then he was 1 year at L.A., and I went to the baseball convention. It was in Phoenix, the Arizona Biltmore. And Al Campanis, the general manager of the Dodgers, asked me to come and visit with him at his suite. And I said, what do you have in mind, Al? He said, we might consider trading Dick Allen. He said, I need to have Tommy John and Terry Forster. Terry Forster was a hard-throwing left-hander. And I said, you might have a chance of getting Tommy John. This is before Tommy had the Tommy John surgery. But we didn't have a very good infield. And Tommy was a sinker ball pitcher, turned the ball over, a lot of ground balls. We had a first baseman without a thumb. We had a second baseman who was erratic, a shortstop who was more erratic than the second baseman. And Bill Melton had a bad back. So I figured, poor Tommy doesn't stand a chance to have success with that interview. Anyway, I didn't mean to touch that one, but that's okay. I'm rambling now. And so I run to Chuck Tanner. I said, Chuck, we have a chance to get Dick Allen. Really? Let's get him. He says, I know his mother. She's a great lady. They live 8 miles from Newcastle where Chuck lived. Allen lived in Wampum, Pennsylvania. He says, I know his brother, Ron, and Harold, Hank Allen. He says, oh, yeah. Oh, I can just see, he says, Allen and our lineup. My gosh, what an athlete, you know. And so it's okay. I said, but let's see if we can get him without giving up Terry Forster. And we ended up making it. Al Campana says to his farm director, there's an infielder you like, Steve Hunt. So then we ran over to our owner, yeah, to let him know that we might get Dick Allen. And he said, you really, guys really want him? And I said, well, listen to Chuck talk about him. And so we made the deal, and then Allen just carried the club, and we almost won that pennant that year. And if Bill Melton didn't hurt his back in mid-season and needed surgery, I think we'd have won it and passed the Oakland Athletics. So Dick was the MVP, and you know, I married the boss's daughter. John Quinn was with the Milwaukee Braves, but then I wasn't very smart. 6 weeks later, the boss quit and went to Philadelphia. So I lost my edge right now. The new regime, I don't think I was as popular with the new group that came in. But anyway, that's another story. And when the season ended, and then we were going to Hawaii for the baseball convention, as I was boarding the plane, someone tapped me on the shoulder and they said, Roland, you know what happened today? Did you hear the news that you've been named the executive of the year by the sporting news? I said, no, really? So I got on the plane, Margot was sitting next to me, I embraced her, and I said, watch this. Then I talked to mother and father were across the aisle. I said, oh, Mr. and Mrs. Quinn, did you hear the good news this morning? They said, no, Roland, what happened? I've been named the executive of the year by the sporting news. Thank you, Dick Allen. So anyway, but Dick was superb last week at the reunion of the 1972 White Sox. And he was so grateful to be remembered so well in Chicago for what he had accomplished at 72 Club. He was the MVP, home run king, RBI. He could steal a base at will. He'd score from first on the double, and he hit some home runs out of sight. There was one game where Chuck had told him, I'll give you some rest here and there. And we won the first game of doubleheader against the Yankees, and Pat Kelly got a big hit to win it. And big house. I mean, it rejuvenated the franchise, because when the year before Chuck and I arrived at the tail end of that year, they only drew 495,000. And Chuck's in Hawaii, they had drawn 497,000. So the White Sox, it looked like they might end up in Milwaukee, Toronto, Seattle. But then with the rejuvenation, that first year we improved by 26 games, I believe it was. And the next year, with Dick Allen aboard, we almost won it. And now we grew about $1.3 million. And we just felt that Dick Allen played a vital role towards saving the franchise, along with the entire club. And Wilbur Wood pitched 376 2/3 innings. And oh, when we talk about Johnny Sane and Chuck Tanner, that first year when we arrived on the scene, I almost traded Wilbur Wood before we get started the 71 season. I had talked to Joe Burke, the general manager of the Washington Senators, about Wood for Darryl Knowles. And Knowles was a good reliever in his own right. And Wilbur hadn't reached that of being connected with Chuck and Johnny. And anyway, Joe Burke backed out at the last minute, so I was very lucky that we still had Wood. I didn't know that he'd become that good, but they talked him into starting, and he wasn't too sure that that made sense. But then when he got going, what a job he did. Like I said, he pitched 4 consecutive years over 300 innings. And the fifth year, he only pitched 292 innings. He only missed by 8 again from hitting. Now, that's unheard of. today, the general manager and the manager would get fired for even attempting to pitch a guy 250 innings. So anyway, but what a combination, Wilbur and Dick Allen. And Wilbur couldn't make it to the reunion because in the last season that we had him, Ron LaFleur hit a pee off his kneecap. I mean, just a shot. And we had a substitute trainer from the Bulls that day because our main trainer, mother was ill. And I'm sitting behind the home plate. I said, oh my gosh, he has to have a broken leg. I rushed to the clubhouse underneath, and I get to the dugout, and Wilbur's hobbling by himself. I figured, doggone it, they should have a stretcher for him or something. And they help him up the dugout steps and down the steps and into the clubhouse, and he says, Roland, will you please get me a cigarette and a beer? That's the medication we gave him. And then they didn't have an ambulance or a car to get him to the hospital. And I was going with him. I had to flag down a cab. And I'm putting his leg in there. And we go by a convenience store. He said, hey, Roland, can you get me a cigarette and a beer? Anyway, I didn't mean to tell that story. But, you know, I'm having fun. We won last night, right? But anyway, we get to the hospital, and then when the doctor came out, the x-ray, it looked like he had been hit like a sword and just broken his kneecap. And it's sad that he couldn't be at our reunion, but he said, I don't get around much anymore, Roland, which is a dirty shame. But and I had known him when he was about 18 years old. Jeff Jones, a scout for the Braves, had sent him in for our people to see him. They had him throw some batting practice, and he hit Del Prando with a pitch. They kicked him off the field. He ended up signing with the Red Sox organization, and then he was a mediocre pitcher until Johnny Sane and Chuck talked him into being a starter.
A pitcher who was a starter, who became a reliever, was Goose Gossage. You traded a young Goose Gossage,
okay,
who recently spoke up about Roger Clemens and steroids. Can you address the conversion of Gossage into a reliever and his recent comments?
A good story about Goose, and he talked, he was at the reunion last weekend. He had was signed by the White Sox before I arrived on the scene the year before. And then that spring, he had pitched at Sarasota in the rookie league, and he gives a lot of credit to Ray Barris, who was a great pitching coach for helping him his foundation when he first started. And then he went to Appleton, Wisconsin, and he was 1-1, it was about the 1st of May, and Joe Sparks, the manager, called me, and he says, boy, this guy throws hard, but they're hitting him as hard as he throws. And Chuck Tanner says, there's an open day on Thursday, and he says, I see Appleton's gonna play in Cedar Rapids. And he said, let's go over there. So we get over to Cedar Rapids, Chuck takes him to a mound on the side there, mound, and he gives him a drill that Johnny Sane would sometimes use with a player. Instead of throwing from on top with the rubber, he started him from the back side of the mound so that his left foot would go towards the rubber, and now he'd have to pull the ball down, and that's how he learned to change up. And now you remember he was 1-1, in late August, I went to Appleton. He ended up that season 18-2 at Appleton. And just having a change of speeds, and not just that overpowering fastball, made such a difference. So it just goes to prove the scouts defined him. And Goose talked about the story that the scout who signed him, Bill Kimball, had seen him in high school. But one of the last games that Gossage pitched as a senior, they pitched him on trying to win a tournament with one day's rest, so he didn't have much on him. And some of the other scouts backed off on him, but Bill Kimball signed him, see, so he didn't let that one bad game. So then, when I went to Appleton and he's tearing it up, he said, hey, Roland, what's the plan for me for next year? I said, think big leagues. We're going to take you to big league camp. And his mother was visiting from Colorado Springs. He ran to her. He said, Roland's going to take us to big league camp. Well, the next spring, he looked pretty doggone impressive. And he pitched against the Yankees. We played two games, one in Caracas and one in Maracaibo, Venezuela. And he pitched in one of those games and ate up the Yankee hitters. And Chuck says he's on the club. So he jumped from Class A to the big leagues. And with Wilbur pitching so long, those young pitchers, Terry Forster, Bart Johnson, and Goose Gossage, didn't have to be used. They wouldn't even get up. You save your whole bullpen. So again, Wynn played a major role, Tanner and Sane, and it's just fantastic to see. And then at the end of the year, we were eliminated from the race, which the last part of September. And God says, hey, Chuck, I can start. So we had a team party the night before, and I don't know that the guys were ready to play the next day, but he got racked real good in about two and a third innings in Minnesota. So he ended up 7-1 for the year. And then years later, when you said that we traded him, when Bill Veeck had the club, he said, we've got such a bad club, there's no way that Gossage and Forster will get any saves. We'll always be behind anyway. He said, let's bring some hitters and excite the fans because they weren't accustomed to having the power hitters with the White Sox. And that's when we traded Gossage to Pittsburgh and got Richie Zisk. And we traded, to the Yankees when we got Oscar Gamble. And then we were the White Sox, Southside hitmen. And we'd be behind 6-1 and say, we have them right where we want because we can come back and score a run. So Bill brought a tremendous excitement to the Southside with these hitters. And he was named the executive of the year for it. He was a genius in his own way, in many ways. Anyway, so I'm back with Gossage. Oh, yeah, so now Gossage, Chuck was now managing Pittsburgh, and they traded when they got Gossage. He called Gossage, and he said, hey, Goose, this is Chuck. And Gossage, Chuck who? Tanner says, Chuck, who? I'm your manager. And he says, you're going back to the bullpen. So he then became the great relief pitcher in the Hall of Famer.
We will turn this over to questions from the audience in a moment. But I have one more question, which is Derek Jeter just passed Cal Ripken Jr. on the all-time hits list. Let's put you in the GM chair. Who would you rather have in your prime?
Either one, you could flip a coin because Ripken, tremendous. You know, I had the dubious distinction of firing his father 6 days into the season. It took a lot of guts and no brains, right? But Cal Ripken and Bill Ripken showed me great respect, and they still did the best they could day in and day out. They never knocked the decision of letting his father go. His father was a great coach, but as a manager, when I went to spring training and I just joined the Orioles, he was still thinking, I think, that he was working for Earl Weaver, and he knew all the preparations and all the drills and all the other coaches being leading on bats. So, but nothing against Cal Ripken Sr. He was a dedicated man and an outstanding baseball man. And then Cal, you know, continuing on to towards the Lou Gehrig record. And I was a positive guy. And Frank Robinson was sitting next to me the day before he was going to tie Lou Gehrig's record. And I said, Frank, I just got a real bad negative thought. He said, that's not you, Roland, talking like that. What is it? Well, Troy Percival was coming in from the bullpen, and he was kind of a hard-nosed, competitive pitcher. I said, wouldn't it be awful if he hit Cal with a pitch and he couldn't play tomorrow? Whew. The first pitch, Cal gets knocked down flat on his back. Then he gets up the next pitch, it's a line drive base hit. Then the next day I kept saying, Is Cal, has he arrived at the ballpark? We should have sent the chauffeured limousine to get him so he wouldn't get into an accident. And then he hit a home run the day he tied the record, and then he hit a home run when he broke the record. And then, a few weeks before, we had an altercation with the Seattle Mariners. And their catcher, Hasselman, charged the mound. Mike Messina, he flipped Messina, and I was worried that Messina got hurt. But Cal got tackled by somebody from the rear. And that morning, that day, the next day, Johnny Oates called me. He said, "Roland, I don't think Cal's going to be able to play today." He told his wife, Kelly, "I don't think I can make it." I said, "Oh, shucks." And this was just a few weeks before he would pat Garrett. And I'm looking out my office window, that warehouse over there, over the right field wall, and I see Cal going up the steps very gingerly. He's walking towards the right field foul line, then he starts jogging, and then he puts it in pretty good gear. So he healed in a hurry. But that was, and then there were times that I would get into talk shows, and some other people in the organization said, "Cal needs a rest." He'd get into a slump. And I said, Frank and I said, "The man upstairs is going to dictate taking him out of the lineup, not us." And I'm glad that we had the courage of our convictions, because those were one of the greatest moments of baseball history, when he broke the Garrett record. When he broke the record, Palmeiro and Bonilla pushed him out to make the tour around the warning track, and he was reluctant to do it. And then, as an official in baseball, as Cal was, it was taking quite a while as he got around, and he's about right center field, and I was told, call downstairs and have the umpire stop this. I says, "Stop this? This is one of the historic moments of the world, you know, in the baseball world. I'll be darned if I'm going to put a stop to it." I said, "Hey, Mike Messina's waiting, our pitcher, he's waiting also." I says, "There's no difference than a rain delay, right?" And I mean, I'm arguing my point. And then when he went by, they said it wasn't fair to the Angels. But then when he went by the Angels' dugout, they were applauding and shaking his hand and everything. So people don't know sometimes some of the trials and tribulations of a general manager in the background, that people are trying to dictate what you have to do. So you have to be immune to criticism. And as a matter of fact, there was a time when we lost our 21 straight to open the season. And that was my first year there. And I was driving with our son Bob, and some guy on a talk show says, "That Heeman must be brain dead." And I'm laughing. My son's all shattered. I said, "He might be right." But anyway, we survived a 21 game streak. I can go on talking about that. When you're involved, you just joined the team and they lose 21 straight. Then you say to yourself, "Well, hey, that's why I got this job, right?" Because they're in trouble. Matter of fact, at spring training, Ed with Bennett Williams, our owner, I think one of the reasons I got the job, he asked me, "When did I start in baseball and where?" I said, "At Hartford, Connecticut." He said, "The Buckley Stadium?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, when I was a youngster," he says, "I sold beer and hot dogs there. The hot dogs were cold and the beer was warm." But it kind of relaxed me also, so I did okay in the interview and he hired me. Then we went to spring training and he said, "What do you think of our club?" I said, "Mr. Williams, I must admit, this is the slowest club I've ever encountered." I said, "I think we're going to have to go back, and you guys might be able to correct me. The 1859 rule, that if an outfielder caught a ball in one hop, the hitter was out." And, you know, when we opened the season, that outfield of ours, I may not give the names, but they were catching all the balls on one hop. Anyway, where are we going from there?
Well, we have about 15 minutes left, so I think we should open this up to our questions from the crowd.
Okay. Way back there.
I'm just curious, do you think Alan Trammell will ever manage in the major leagues again?
I'm sorry?
will Alan Trammell ever manage again?
Well, first of all, I'd like to see Alan Trammell get into the Hall of Fame as a player. I challenge all of you to start putting some figures together. Now, Barry Larkin's going in this year, and I'd like to see how they rate side by side and other shortstops that would be as good as what Trammell did. He and Trammell and Whitaker, when they arrived on the scene, I remember right out of Double A, and Sparky Anderson, brilliant manager, even when double play situations were sometimes they shade towards the bag, these two guys were so good as youngsters and so quick. Most of the time they would play the regular position so they'd catch balls in the hole, you know, to the right of the shortstop or the left of the second baseman, and then still make the double plays. I mean, they would fly across the bag. They were just beautiful to watch. And he said, "You're right, Roland, we did play wide." He said, "But once in a while, Sparky would shorten us up." But and Bertie Tebbets, great baseball man that I had some association with, and he played a major role in my career as well, used to say, "Trammell's a Hall of Famer. Trammell's a Hall of Famer." So somebody has to put figures together to pit him against other shortstops that are in the Hall now. But I think it would be, I'm not computer literate, so I challenge you guys to come up with something and see how he does with Larkin in comparison. All right? Yes.
When Bennett Williams took over the Baltimore Orioles, he was a Washington lawyer, and there was rumor going around Washington that he wanted to bring the Orioles to Washington.
I'm not aware specifically on that. When I got there, I didn't hear that we might move to. Unfortunately for Mr. Williams, he came down with cancer, so then he had to go through that year that was so bad, so he must have thought I was the worst general manager in the history of the game. But then, very big moment when we were on that long losing streak, we finally won a game in Chicago. Before we hit Chicago, Eddie Einhorn, one of the owners of the White Sox, called me in Minnesota. He wanted us to win a game and not do it against the White Sox for the first victory. And he said, "We're going to mail you the suit that they had hung up in the frame of when we clinched the 1983 Western Division of the American League." And I'd worn a suit that I took a chance that I didn't mind losing. It was a bad suit anyway. And then when I went into the clubhouse after a lot of the celebration, they just drowned me with beer and champagne. But I had another suit to change through to get home. And I said, "Well, you're going to have to hurry because Federal Express hadn't started yet. They couldn't guarantee like a 10:30 delivery." And I said, "We're playing an afternoon game starting at noon in Minnesota." So I had another suit on, and I told the visiting clubhouse man, I said, "If my suit arrives, let me know. See, and then I'll run in and put it on." So it didn't come in until about the eighth inning, so I rushed in, put on the suit, rushed up to the press box, and Ken Rosenthal and Tim Kirkchen were there. I said, "Watch the magic suit." And the first hitter, Carl Nichols, weak hitting catcher, got a base hit. I said, "Boy, the suit's working." Next guy, double play, pop up, we lose again. So the next day, we're going to Chicago, so I wear that lucky suit again by the Orioles dugout, and we beat them 7-0. And a friend of mine, the last call for beer, got the biggest jug of beer he could find sitting behind me. And when the final out comes, he said, "How about it, Roland?" I said, "Yeah, go ahead." Anyway, yes.
I'd like to know how you were able to cope with the transition with agents and free agency in the 70s.
Yeah, well, I know that when free agency came about, Bill Veeck, they would come on teletype how much guys had just signed for. They say, is anybody putting a gun to their heads? You know, what's happening? And that led, though, to Bill not able to compete anymore. And he finally threw in the towel. He wasn't in a position to compete with the free agency rules and the higher contracts. And then when Jerry Reinsdorf and Eddie Einhorn came, then we signed Carlton Fisk. And I think it was $600,000 a year for 5 years. And we thought that was big money. And I was a big Red Sox fan growing up, and we were going to play our first game in Boston. They had lost them on a technicality where they mailed this contract one day late, and I really kind of felt sorry for them, but Jerry Capstein, his agent, called me and asked, he's from Rhode Island, and he said, do you have interest in Carlton Fisk? Well, I had told Tony, I wanted Tony to fly in La Russa so that our new owners could meet him. And I said to Jerry Reinsdorf, you could spend about 3 hours with him and then you tell me what you think also. So then I told Tony, I said, watch me, I'm going to check the new owners. That I just heard that Carlton Fisk was going to be the free agent. And they said, really? So I said, so when they came in to my little office, and Eddie Einhorn says, did you hear about Carlton Fisk being a free agent? And I said, yeah. He said, should we be interested? I said, yeah, by all means. We got a young pitching staff, and he could still play. I scout Leo LaBassia, who saw him a lot in New England that year, turned into, yes, Roland, boy, we should try to get him. And well, then the phone rang, and I had predicted that we had to say that we're interested because with Bill Veeck, we couldn't sign those high-priced players. So Jerome Holtzman called, and I pick up the phone, and Jerry and Eddie are there. And they said, he said, do you know that Carlton Fisk was declared a free agent? I said, yeah. He says, are you interested? So I cover the phone. They gave me a little weak yes. By all means, we are. Because I said, it's going to make the papers, the headlines that we're interested, and now at least we're in the hunt. Anyway, we ended up signing him. We, I said, we should leave town, and Jerry Capstein was in La Jolla, had an office in California, so we flew there. Nobody knew where we were, and they didn't suspect that we were serious bidders, but we did sign him. It took about 3 weeks in the spring training to finally get it done, and then we were going to open in Boston. I said, oh my gosh, I feel sorry for Heywood Sullivan and the Red Sox people, but what are you going to do? Fisk was a home run in the bottom of the top of the eighth inning, three-run homer off Bob Stanley. And I kissed my sister and ran down about five rows and kissed Linda Fisk too. So that was a good celebration. Then we came home, and Fisk hit a home run off Pete Vukovich in the first inning, a grand slam. So, you know, he had a flair for the dramatics. So that was another exciting moment in my career. Yes?
Your fondest memory of Bill Veeck?
Well, there are so many. I could talk about Bill Veeck for the next, what's my allotted time? Is it already 2:25? Have I been on for almost an hour? See, I'm tired of hearing my own stories all the time. No, you've been a very good audience. Bill Veeck, incomparable. A genius, a great person. I mean, just, he helped me so much. He said, let your imagination run rampant. Propose anything. I'll tell you if it's been tried before, maybe it didn't work, but it can work, or we embellish it. And after we came back from the winter meetings, J.C. Martin was applying to be an announcer. And Bill's office was right across the men's room. And we had to go to a speaking engagement at downtown Chicago that day. And it was getting close to the time that we should be leaving. So Bill had told me he had an open door policy. So, but I opened his door, it was open, but I shut it behind me, and he was on the phone. And he looked at me like, what's wrong? As soon as he hung up, he said, why did you shut the door? I said, well, J.C. Martin's been waiting, and we have to be downtown in just a few minutes. He says, oh, he knows to come back at 1:30. So I says, I'm sorry, Bill. Never happened again. I had to go on the road for something. I came back. He had the walls knocked out of his room. So they had no doors. The walls were all knocked down. He said, and he'd be talking trades with people or different things, and people would be walking by, and there was the employee's dining room. He said, this works better because people who might hear something, they'll show the respect of not repeating it. While if you have a shut door and then three people step out, somebody said, what's going on? And you say, well, don't tell anybody. And it's in the papers the next day. So, I mean, you can see how creative he was. And I mean, it's just fabulous to be with him on a day-in, day-out basis. And because he had a lot of pain, I'm sure, we'd stay after games, and a lot of times we wouldn't leave till 2, 3 in the morning from the barge room. And I'd be back at 9, and so would he. And he'd be soaking his limbs, you know, at 6 in the morning. So people say, how long did you work with Bill? I said, well, the calendar said 5 years, but it was really 10 because I only got 3 out of 4 hours sleep instead of 8 or 9. Yes.
What can you tell us about how you dealt with disco in Derby night?
Yeah, okay, that's another good story. I had taken Bill to the hospital every once in a while. He had emphysema, and he still smoked. She knew it was a bad habit, but I'd be driving him to the hospital, he'd turn the window down, he'd stick his head out and say, drive a little faster so I can breathe better. So I get him to the hospital, and I figure I won't see him for a few days. And the day of disco demolition, it was his son who had set up that promotion. All of a sudden, Bill's in. I said, what are you doing here, Bill? He said, I checked myself out. I said, why, Bill? He said, well, this could be catastrophic tonight. I mean, he could predict things and human behavior. And so really, so then I sat with him upstairs, and he sat in the second row of the press box. And I said, Bill, this is the greatest promotion I've ever heard of. I said, they're climbing the walls to get in. We've got a full house. The traffic is all the way to Wrigley Field. And he said, no, Roland, this could be bad. So as it progressed a little bit, and Don Kessinger's the manager, and it get pretty rowdy, Don called me and says, can my family come up to the box? He says, I'm worried that they might get hurt here. People were misbehaving. And then I said, yeah, I went down to get them. But then there was smoke coming up from the field. I said, Bill, I don't know what, that odor is different than I've been accustomed to. There was so much marijuana smoking. I said, hey, Bill, I'm getting a little high here. I said, that stuff's pretty good. And then, so then they had Cleveland a 10-cent beer night about 4 weeks before, and they ended up with a riot there. And Nestor Shylock was the umpire in chief there, so he was getting worried. And then if we hadn't had to play a doubleheader, see, we had a second game to play, I think we'd have survived it a lot better. But Sparky Anderson didn't want to play because of what had transpired in Cleveland, which he had played against the Indians during that episode. So then when they lit up all the bonfire of the records in center field, and then all these youngsters jumped out on the field, and some were trying to steal second base, others were trying to take the pitching rubber, and Bill's down on the field with a microphone, would you please get off the field so we can play the second game? And I went by Harry Carey. I says, hey, Harry, you think you can perform miracles? See what you can do. So he was on the microphone too, but nothing helped, and they canceled the second game, and we forfeited, so that was pretty sad. Yes. But it was a great promotion because we're still talking about it, right?
Roland, what do you think about Marvin Miller? Somebody asked me here about Marvin Miller going into the Hall of Fame, and I said that my experience experience from the book, a lot of executives who are on the committee were not big on Miller going into the Hall of Fame, and that's one reason why he hasn't gotten it so
far. Yeah,
a lot of people think he'll go in after he dies. What do you think?
I'm a proponent that he deserves it, strangely as you might think, because I think that free agency, you know, sometimes gets out of line, but yet the popularity of the game has increased because I think people said, if those players are getting that kind of money, we better go see them play, right? So I think he elevated the interest in the game to a great extent.
I agree.
And I'm surprised that the players on these committees sometimes don't vote for him. But, you know, I got a raise. I think Marvin Miller helped me get some raises because the players got more money, so they had to kind of, as a general manager, not that I was in the era where they paid that much, but at least they knew the job was tougher to get, you know, to work. I mean, I feel sorry for a general manager who will sign a guy for 10 years now, and he breaks down the first year or second year or third year. So it's not easy. The general managers have a tough job. But Marvin Miller, and see, it came back to haunt Bill Veeck too because he had supported the Curt Flood deal. And then when he came about, then free agency came about, but Bill had testified on behalf of Curt Flood. So he was a visionary that a player shouldn't be kept in captivity, so to speak, or in perpetuity under contract. And I know when I broke in, when there was a holdout, they said, Roland, don't worry about it, he'll sign. If he doesn't sign, we'll send him the Podunk. I used to hear Podunk all the time. I never knew where that town was. So one day I was driving from Cooperstown to New York, and there was a sign, Podunk. Does anybody know where Podunk is? But I used to hear that term.
Yeah,
I remember.
We have time for one more question.
One more question.
Okay. There's been a hand up.
One that I probably shouldn't say, but I will. My father-in-law was negotiating with Lou Burdett. And Lou lived in Anna Maria Island, and the Braves were training in Bradenton. So finally, Burdett says, I'll meet you halfway, John. John says, okay. They had like a 5,000 differential, probably. John says, oh, 2,500? You look. No, he says, I'll meet you halfway to the bar between Bradenton and Anna Maria. Okay.
You take the one question here.
What was the thinking behind the Angels moving from Los Angeles to Anaheim? Why Anaheim? It was kind of a little backwater.
Yeah, well, they were willing to build a new ballpark. See, we were the tenants at Dodger Stadium. First of all, when I went from the Braves to the Angels, Fred Haney, who had been the general manager, the manager of the champion Braves, hired me to be the farm and scouting director. So we went to Los Angeles, and the first year we played at Old Wrigley Field, that had been the AAA Angels, and then we moved to the Dodger offices. And the Dodgers had beautiful offices overlooking the field, and we were in the catacombs down below. And then as we were playing there, we were second fiddle to the Dodgers. They were drawing twice as much as us. Well, maybe I'll give you the final details. Gene Autry was getting tired of the fact that we weren't getting the publicity that they did. And Walter O'Malley would charge us half price for the plants and the watering of the plants and all the beautiful situations. And then he was charging us for half of the toilet papers. And Gene says, well, it's time to leave because they outdraw us 2-1. Why should we pay half? Okay, sorry. There was a chance we were going to be in Long Beach or Anaheim. In Anaheim, they voted to get a ballpark. And we had just moved, we're real close to Dodger Stadium. And I said to Fred Haney, I said, we're thinking about buying a home here in San Marino, right at the end of, sounds good when you say San Marino, but it was really almost South Pasadena, one block away. But if you said San Marino, people, you thought that you were wealthy. Anyway, but it's only a short drive to Dodger Stadium. He said, well, it'll probably take 2 or 3 years, you know how it is. And they built that ballpark within a year. So then I'd be driving my Volkswagen 31 miles to Anaheim every day. Then I'd try to come home for dinner a lot of times. We had a growing family and go back. So I'd put on 124 miles on in my fancy Volkswagen. That's all I could afford. Anyway.
We're a little over, so, you know, thank you, Roland.
Pardon? In reverse, I want to give you a standing ovation. I love being a member of Sabre. I love the fact that passion and love, and that you love Aggies so much and what you have provided. I think you have helped the popularity of Aggies to grow what it is today, because you've enlightened a lot of people the value of this game and how much it means in different generations and grandparents with their children, and then the grandparents to tell about the past and the children who pay attention and grasp what you're saying and to enjoy baseball for all that it's worth. So thank you very much. Hope to see you next year. Thank you.